We're talking with Jeremy Corbell about his film Patient 17, some odd results that they got from testing. We're going to get into details about what came back from the lab and a little bit more about how the patient felt and what experiences he remembers right after this on Coast to Coast. Jeremy, just to reset the stage, so the surgery takes place. These doctors, these two surgeons, use this Gauss detector to help locate where this object is. And I don't want to overstate it too much. You're not saying that it's putting out some radio signal, but you're saying it's putting out a signal that suggests at least that it's metal. That's all you know for sure?
Yeah, I don't know much about it. It appears that it's emitting some kind of electromagnetic frequency. I think that's what piqued everybody's interest. That was one of the criteria, let's say, you know, for Dr. Lear. That was a big red flag that this is not just an average piece of, you know, construction material in a guy's leg. So, you know, that was probably one of the precursors to why they decided to go in, besides his abductive experiences, of course. That happened. That was weird. You know, page two, what happens next? They cut it out, you know, and then we go from there.
Where do you go from there? Where do you take it to get it tested?
Yeah, you go to your local scanning electron microscopy lab.
Oh, yeah, there's one on every corner.
Right. Yeah, it was a big learning curve for me. But luckily, I had been kind of entrenched, within the scientific field with my documentary work. So I was no stranger to, you know, electron microscopy. So essentially, it's a really powerful microscope. And, you know, there's a great lab called Seal Labs, and that is where Dr. Lear said, you know, Jeremy, come on down here, we're filming. I'm like, okay, cool. So we went down there, and, you know, to me, it was like, you know, the lunar landscapes, you know, that our good friend John Lear always says, do you see that, Jeremy? That's a bucket wheel excavator. That is a cube on the moon. You know, and I can't see exactly what he's seeing, you know.
Right.
That's kind of what the lab was like. You know, everything looks amazing when you look at it, you know, under this kind of myopic view. So it was like a lunar landscape, and you're going across it, and it is an alloy, and we can see that, and there are little strings coming off of it. And Steve Colburn is a, you know, carbon nanotube specialist, apparently, and so he was going to test for that through Raman spectroscopy, and, you know, it just looks cool. That was the first day. We thought we were getting answers. Patient 17 thought he was getting answers on that day, and we look at it through this microscope, and it looks really wild, and I turn to Dr. Lear, and I say, so are we going to figure out, is this alien, you know, what is this, you know, and he just looks at me and goes, no. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, we have to do other tests. Not every lab does every test. And I'm like, okay, well.
So Seal Labs, do they know what they're testing? They know the circumstances of where it came from?
No. I mean, kind of. I mean, there's a bunch of film people in the room, and, you know, they know Dr. Lear at this point. They know that we think that it could be extraordinary. But essentially, it's real, just X's and O's, ones and zeros. Like, put it in, look at it. You can get a very, very basic elemental analysis. You get kind of peaks when you hit something. You know, is it carbon? Is it aluminum? You know, you can get some very basic elemental analysis with this particular machine. But it was kind of to look at it and see what it looked like. Did it look like a nail? You know, and so that was kind of the first step.
And what was the answer? Did it look like a nail? Or a
no,
piece of
it didn't look like a nail. It was absolutely not a nail. No, it was, you know, just from visual appearance, it had an outer shell that kind of cracked off. It was, you know, metal or an alloy on the inside. It had these strange-looking fibers that were kind of wisping out of it. Now, there are theories to that. You know, this is not where I'm standing. I'm looking at this. But within the organization that Dr. Lear founded, you know, they have certain ideas of what these things are and what's coming off of them. For me, it looked like the moon. It looked like this incredible micro landscape, and it was beautiful.
Did the lab give you any kind of a formal report, written or otherwise, that says, here's what we think about it?
They take photos and, you know, send images and show kind of peaks, you know, when you hit a peak of carbon or you hit a peak of aluminum, like, you know, they'll give that. But really, what I've learned is that the best thing is to send it to a completely independent lab and just say, what is this? And broad spectrum elemental analysis and isotopic analysis are the two kind of important ways you can interrogate an unknown object, which I happen to end up doing a lot now, apparently. I've become the guy to, like, interrogate unknown objects, which I never expected.
Okay, so so that test was done, Seal Labs. Then what's the next step? Where'd it go from there?
Okay, so then there was a big lull, and it was during this lull that Dr. Lear passed away. And, you know, he was hot to do, you know, to give me this whole presentation. He was like, okay, I got this idea. I'm going to show you the presentation, the history, the slides. I mean, he was, like, ready to film it. I talked to him the day he passed away, and it was like, it was just normal conversation. And he was yelling at me, actually, about something. And it was like, you know, he was adamant. It was like, this is the next step. We got to do this. We have to film together. I have to give you all my research, tell you what happened. And he passed away. And
he thought this was the one, right?
You know, he, I think, was very hopeful because of all the people interested in filming it. I think that this was definitely, he knew more now than he did when he started. So he figured he could interrogate this object properly. It was promising, I think, in his field of research. And look, it's a tragedy. I showed him the majority of my film before he passed away, by the way. I cut quick. So I edited and I cut all the stuff regarding him. And he was so pleased with it that he wanted to move forward and move forward fast. And then he passed away. And it was, you know, look, he lived a great long life. But it's sad. It's tragic for the field of this study of physical evidence in ufology. And then the person that kind of picked up the torch, although I think very kind of almost like unwillingly, you know, is, you know, Steve Colburn, because, you know, he's kind of a shy person. And I don't think, you know, look, Dr. Lear had a gravitas about him. Like, he'd just go for it. He didn't really care. So it takes a certain type, you know, to put themselves out like that. And I hope the research is going to continue. And I'm trying to help. I'm trying with patient 17 to get the sample, to do more tests, because I happen to have a unique, you know, position where I can get this stuff tested at the highest levels, at the best labs, by the greatest minds.
So Dr. Lear dies. I mean, I guess for a point you have to think, gosh, the project is done. It's dead. Or did you think that?
I at that point, I was kind of thrown for a loop. I was like, wow, okay, well, so I'm doing a memorial, you know, film. And that's kind of where I was at. But then I realized, look, it's my duty as a, I guess, self-claimed investigative filmmaker. I want to know the truth at this point, and I want to know it for patient 17. It's not cool to just leave him hanging. And so everybody can say what they think it is and go from there, you know, from Z to A. They can moonwalk backwards and say what it is. But, you know, I actually want to know. And I think that there's a way to get closer to that answer. That answer may be appealing to some people, and it may not to others, but I think we can get closer. And you know what? At least we're going to try.
We're going to come back to the testing issue, because you did get some additional information. Let's talk about Steve Colburn for a moment. So he's working with Dr. Lear as part of this project. He's kind of a controversial guy, though, right?
I've heard a lot of controversy. If you look him up on the internet, of course, he's a very controversial person. I find him to be a soft-spoken, gentle person that seems to be kind of shy and he seems very excited, you know, about the research. And when I offered to pay for the broad spectrum elemental analysis and the isotopic analysis, he was elated. I mean, he too wants to know. He turns out, has reasons he wants to know. And, man, we all want to know, George.
I'll tell you what, there's a little clip we have of an interaction you have with him. It's like about 30 seconds long. It's audio file 5. Why don't we listen to this and then you tell us what we've heard. Nathan, if you could play that.
Well, if this thing is emitting frequency, there's got to be a way to capture that data somehow.
The ultimate goal is to hack the alien internet. We have reason to believe there's a complex web of communication between aliens and some supercomputer someplace, and abductees are also plugged into this system. It's the biggest story of the 20th and 21st centuries. It's the biggest story never told.
All right, that sounds like some pretty far-out stuff there, tapping into the alien internet or whatever. And why did he get to that point? Why did he get to that conclusion? What about that sample told him there was something really weird going on?
Well, I think it's all the samples. Like, he comes from a very unique position that I think I'm going to illuminate in my film, okay? And essentially, he believes that. You know, he has reason to believe that. And he does believe that these objects, so if I'm him, I'm saying objects are being implanted in people, and people are being abducted. This is happening, okay? So these objects are emitting a frequency. We're probably picking up, it's like a Jupiter's symphony. It's like the symphony that was made with like these five parts to it that, like, they said only Jupiter the god could hear because it's too complex for the human mind. So maybe what we're picking up is just like a little bit of radio frequency from a much broader frequency, and that this is somehow pumping into some supercomputer that is then taking all that data from these abductees who are being studied biologically by these implants and then processing that information. So this is what Steve is saying in this clip, and it's, you know, from the film. This is the belief system around it, that this is a possibility.
Well, he says in another clip, he says something to the effect of, you're talking about isotopic ratios in the samples, that they're different from earthly elements. Is that true? I mean, do you have evidence that there was something in this sample that's different?
Okay, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty, and this is key. Okay, so there were two major tests that I paid for at Northern Analytic. And essentially, one test is broad spectrum elemental analysis. What we found, and this is before the isotopes, right? What we found is that there are 36 different elements within this one tiny little piece of metal. 36. What I've been told, and I'd really love to talk to some material scientists. I've gone to UCLA. I've talked with some people. But, what I was told is like an average nail, you know, you have maybe four or five elements. There are some extremely rare elements in here. And I've talked to scientists out in Alamogordo who worked on the atom bomb to nanotechnicians. And it turns out, with this elemental analysis, the majority is iron in this object. But there are trace elements that are so exotic and so many of them that this has started to become very interesting. 36 different elements, including tantalum, which is like a rare earth element, and yttrium, rare earth. It's bizarre. I did not expect to see such a complex alloy coming out of a man's leg. Some of the comments made to me by people in aerospace industry is that this is a fabricated, highly advanced alloy built for strength.
It's an alloy manufactured.
Yes,
with multiple elements. Did they give you any kind of opinions about the combination of events? Had they ever seen this particular combination of elements before? Is there something else that's comparable to it?
Okay, oddly enough, you asked that question because I was sitting at a table with a nanophysicist or nanotechnician and this one scientist out in Alamogordo, and he was reading through them and looking at them. He's worked in a lot of really, really advanced propulsion programs, and he actually looked at the different ratios. Because remember, there are parts per million. There's tiny, tiny little parts. It's mainly iron. And he came up with some things about, like, you know, how they built superconductors and that we have so much yttrium in it, like 410 parts per million, really high for, I guess, what you'd normally find if you cut a piece of rock or gravel off the ground. This is what I've been told. So, yeah, there's speculation, but I don't tell these scientists. I just hand them the piece of paper, and I say, is this interesting in any way, or is this not? It's a piece of metal.
And they've all said it sure is.
Yeah, they all said it. They all said it's interesting.
There's no such thing as a piece of unobtainium in there, though. No unidentified object, no something from another planet, anything like that?
Okay, so now we get really weird, okay? Steep learning curve. I have learned a lot about isotopes, and I don't know if people know what isotopes are, but essentially they have to do with atomic weights. So we did two isotopic tests, one for copper and one for zinc. So for example, zinc, you have five but four register different isotopes of zinc, atomic weights. So on average, if you cut out a piece of mountain, and you're going to have zinc 64, 66, 67, and 68, and they're going to have percentages. There's a standard percentage from our supernova that created all the zinc this way. Now, even on Wikipedia, if you go outside of 1% variation, 1% variation from, let's say, zinc 64, which is the one I've targeted it in on because of the reports, that is pretty massive. 1%, you know, would denote something that is extraterrestrial, not formed here, and maybe it's even not in our own solar system or our own supernova. Now, there are some issues with this, but sure enough, I'll give you the direct numbers. I'm going to publish these for everybody. I'm not a scientist. I want people to look at this. But I have just zeroed it down. Zinc 64, the atomic weight, zinc 64 in this sample, if this data, and we need to do more tests. That's why I'm trying to get the object again with patient 17 so we can do more tests like this. But right now, if correct, we are 2.5% outside of the terrestrial ratios of zinc 64. Now, there is a margin of error. That margin of error, if we push it all the way back, we're still 1.2% above anything terrestrial. And if we push it all the way forward, we're 3.7% at its highest outside the terrestrial ratios. So the question here is, it's about zinc 64 and the isotopes in zinc 64 isotopes. Why did we come back from a lab with a ratio of zinc 64 that is outside the terrestrial norm by 2.5% on average? Why?
That's pretty weird. At a minimum, the combination of all those elements is pretty weird.
I think so. I need more material scientists. I mean, I went to UCLA and I talked with the meteorite specialist who ran the meteorite museum. I'm basically knocking on these dudes' doors. I mean, if there's a material scientist that's listening tonight that would like to look at it, I will take any and every opinion on this. I am open. I just want to learn the truth.
So, but, getting back to the basics, though, this is in a guy's leg. It's been there for a number of years. It's strange. He doesn't know how it got there. There's no entry point that anybody can see. It's not a rock. It's not a nail from a construction site. That much is clear.
Look, any way you eat your eggs is still a chicken, man. We can't deny the fact of how this all started. The patient 17 is an ordinary individual, but he had extraordinary personal experiences. And that's really what my movie's about. I mean, look, this is a fun little hunt here, you know, for this object, for these isotopes. I'm learning so much about science that I didn't in college. I love this. This is great. But bottom line is, this is a man's life. This is a man who's had experiences, and he wants answers. And I'm hoping that some of this analysis will shed light on that. And I'm going to make everything public after my film, put all the documents online and let people tear them to shreds. You know, let people decide for themselves. I'm just, as you do, George, I'm just reporting the news.
Are the tests that have been done, are they destructive tests? Have you lost some of the sample? Has it been destroyed because of the...
And some aren't. You know, definitely when you do broad spectrum elemental analysis and isotopic analysis, you need to dissolve and isolate and purify the materials. And that's the other thing. That's why I need to do more tests, because there can be contamination in isotopic tests. So we need a variety of tests, and it is destructive piece by piece. So we have to get the best labs who can use the littlest amount. And I have connections to those labs and people that are willing to help, and it's for free, and I just need to get the sample and get it moving on these things. So it is destructive. There's one test in particular that even Steve Colburn is real excited if I can get done, and I would get it done at NIST.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I want to hear the story of where the sample is and why you're having problems getting it back. We'll get into that, and we'll hear more from patient 17 about these quizzical results right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Jeremy Corbell has been telling us about this strange sample taken out of the leg of an alleged alien abductee, some of the testing that takes place. There's still more test results that we're going to hear about from a guy known as Nano Man a little bit later. But in the next segment, we're going to go back to the patient himself and hear how he reacted to this news and what he thinks happened to him. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeremy Corbell, you were hinting before the break that you'd like to do some more tests on this strange object taken out of this guy's leg, patient 17, but you're not able to do that right now. Where is the sample?
Yeah, I think, you know, trust just needs to be earned, and I think we're close to it. You know, Steve Colburn was tasked by Dr. Lear to be the custodian of these objects, and he's doing a good job. And essentially, you know, he's the one that I need to deal with in order to get more tests. He wants more tests done. It's not like it's that difficult. The coordination of it is difficult at this point. I think we're going to get there. At the end of the day, this came out of patient 17's leg. As far as I'm concerned, it's his object. Everybody else can look at him like through a microscope, but it's his. And he wants to know truth. And, you know, hopefully we can get it and look more. And are we going to get answers or more answers? I mean, I hope so. The test I was alluding to before is atomic milling. It's a real special technique. They have it at NIST, and you can really get some layered understanding of what you have. And that's real important. I learned that through this other project with a guy named Nanoman, is that there things can be on the nanoscale, they can be layered. And so you have to penetrate through the first layer to see what that is, and then you move into the second layer. You know, on the microscopic scale, things become so fascinating the closer you look. So I think we're going to get there. I think Steve's doing a great job. He's holding the samples. You have to earn trust. Man, I feel like I have to earn trust every day from everybody doing this, but I feel like I've earned it. So.
Well, it's a strange little universe, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. So at a minimum, though, this is an odd combination of stuff that's in this guy's leg. Maybe explainable. Maybe it is explainable still, and more testing would tell us that.
I'm going to find out. If anybody is, I'm going to find out.
Let's hear a little bit more from patient 17 himself. I mean, he's come to grips with the experiences that led him down this path, in a sense. Our file number 10 continues a conversation between patient 17 and Jeremy Corbell.
Are you saying to me that you feel strongly that the experiences you had were real?
Well, the experiences of childhood are real memories. And what happened in Vegas with the two abductions were real. But this fine details aren't there. Like I said in earlier conversations, maybe they are doing mental blocks on people because they know how frightening it is for the human race to deal with all this, but they still feel like we do with this animals, they can do what they want with us.
Do you feel that you were given a mental block from the experiences that you had?
Absolutely. There's no other way they could have made me forget about it. So however that's done, I'm glad that's possible, because just knowing they were there in my room from childhood, sometimes in young adult, and now with this possible implant, you kind of feel violated. I mean, these people are like kidnapping you.
So, Jeremy, this guy obviously has somewhat come to grips with it. He thinks it's real. It really happened to him. You know, I've interviewed a lot of abductees over the years, and I think most of them are honestly relating things that they think they are remembering and not trying to get attention. This guy does not sound like he wanted attention, but he's sort of made an about-face. Am I being accurate in describing that?
Yeah, I mean, no, he does not want attention. He never did want attention. You know, I think he feels comfortable with me in the way that I'm approaching his story, which is very factual, which is, you know, from a very straightforward point of view. I don't have my own agenda of what I think this is. I don't put any preconceived notions on it. And I think that he respects that path or that way to look at it. And he has come to terms with it. You know, he knows his experiences were real. And that's the bottom line. I mean, and now what this object is, that's what we're trying to look into. But absolutely, you know, he knows that what experiences that he had were real. They started in childhood. I mean, you'll see in my movie, I mean, you know, his parents put locks up high up on the doors where he couldn't reach him to get out. Yet he was found outside over and over, and the locks were still locked on the inside.
Is this a transformation for him, this process? Did he want to believe it in the beginning, or was he denying it? And has he changed?
Many, many times throughout the film, you'll see him be the most skeptical person. He you know, changes from time to time. Like, he'll embrace it, and then, you know, he doesn't want to be seen. You know, he's not part of any UFO group. He's not part of any support group. He hasn't learned about this from other people. This is a very pure case, you know. So he goes back and forth of wanting nothing to do with it, just live his life. You know, what makes him happy is to spend time with his lady and, you know, ride his motorcycles and do all the cool stuff that life has to offer. This does not control his life. You know, we're just trying to get some answers here, and we're going to close the book on this, and everybody else can eat it up and change it and look at it and do whatever. But
well, before we do that, there's some other stuff I want to hear from him. There's an audio file 12 that I'd like to play now. Nathan, if you would.
You know, with all this going on, I'm just like a normal guy with extraordinary experiences that can't really be explained. You know, you've gone through them, but unless you meet other abductees or somebody in the line of work, nobody believes you. Nobody really cares. And they really just want to put their fingers in their ears and walk away. They're just afraid of the truth, maybe. I mean, when it happens to them or they know somebody personally that this stuff happens to me, they'll open their eyes.
Has he told the people around him, I mean, immediate family, friends, coworkers, has he told them about these experiences, or has he tried to pretty much keep them to himself?
No, that's what's so, like, isolating about all this is no, he didn't. He doesn't tell people about this. I mean, you know, he says, you'll see in the film, I mean, he even talks a little bit about how he, you know, has confided in the people closest to him, and, you know, people are like, why are you letting them cut into your body and pull this out? Just, you know, they're doing it for their own personal agendas. Don't be part of it, you know. So he was really kind of told he shouldn't do it, you know, and I'm sure there are days when he wishes he didn't, but ultimately, you know, his identity, it's up to him if he wants to talk about it or tell more of the story, but, you know, I think he has trust and faith in the way I'm making my film to really open up, and I think that the film will be more about the human spirit and about an individual who's facing adversity than about extraterrestrials. I mean, the movie is called Patient 17 now. I mean, it's about him, you know?
Are we going to – do we learn his name in the film, or is that going to be up to him whether
that's,
he releases –
it's going to be up to him. You know, when the film premieres at the UFO Congress – February probably 20th, I think they're going to play it on a Friday, when it premieres, you know, that'll be the first taste people get of it. And then when the film gets out there, it's wholly up to him. If he wants to step forward, he can step forward and talk more about it. I'm sure people will be interested.
But we see his face in the film.
Yeah, you see his face in the film, but, you know, he can keep his privacy. It's up to him.
There's one other clip from the interview I found pretty interesting. It's audio file 8, where he comes to grips with what he's dealing with here, if we could play that.
Say to an alien that was trying to abduct you if you could?
I don't know if I'd say anything rather than just treat them to any, like any burglar that was trying to break into my house and mess with my family is shoot them dead and I'll take them down. I mean, I think they're criminals. They're doing what they want and a lot of cruel things to people, and be nice if a little payback. Because this is unreasonable. How many abductees do you really need? How many people's lives do you have to ruin? I mean, you know, man up, show your face or take off. And for them to, you know, always take you on a deserted road or late at night, they're obviously cowards on top of it. So they're criminals, they're cowards. They're that advanced, they should be able to just talk to us and explain things out and comfort us rather than like mean little kids with a magnifying glass frying ants on a sunny day. Cowards. So leave me alone, and I hope I can take one of you out when it's possible.
Do you have an idea how many experiences he's had or he thinks he's had?
Yeah, I mean, I would say he's related, you know, quite vividly, you know, three experiences, but I think it was going on, you know, all throughout his childhood. You know, I think that with these circumstances, if any of this is real, you know, then there is something where there's a control over the memory, you know, your ability to remember. And I think that if he would go and try to kind of go deeper into his memories, he'd probably learn more, but that gets kind of sketchy. And also, straight up, Dr. Lear offered that to him, and he didn't want to do it. He says, just in the film, you'll see, I can't keep saying that, you will see in the film, he says, if you could see these images, you know, what I saw, you wouldn't want to remember anymore. So I think that's kind of what he's talking about. He just wants to be left alone. He doesn't want these experiences to continue. And they've slowed down. And he wants to move on with his life and have a good life, you know, just like any of us. Work hard, play hard, that's it.
He hasn't joined any abductee groups.
No.
He hasn't undergone regression at all.
No, he doesn't want to.
Because I guess he must have read enough about it to know that there are risks with that, that it kind of confuses things.
Yeah, and I don't think he wants to spend that much time on it. You know, look, he's not a victim. You can hear by the way he speaks. You know, he's a warrior. He's a tough guy. Like, you know, he'll take one out if he could. You know, he doesn't, from what I can tell at this point, and hopefully you'll hear from him yourself, you know, George, I would love to have him on the show at some point just to kind of hear it out of his own mouth. But essentially, that should be after the release of the film if he decides he wants to do that. But essentially, yeah, he just he wants to move on with his life. And that's part of what this film is about, and that's part of what this research is about. Let's close the book on this and move forward.
Well, he has, if he's listening tonight, he has an open invitation to come on the program after
I definitely think after the premiere of the film, that's something we should do.
All right, Patient 17, that's another project. You have the Lear Project, the Citizen Hearing Project, the Anonymous Interview Project, and then Patient 17, but that's not all you've got cooking. The same sort of twisted path leads you somewhere else to a guy we'll call Nanoman, who he's his own project, but he also has input on this one, right?
Yeah, they all started cross-referencing, and it's very bizarre how this happened. Look, I want to be straightforward, which is my introduction to the world of studying ufology was actually through military contacts. It's very strange to me that is the case, but essentially each of these people connect to one another in a very, very bizarre fashion. And I have a lot of projects that are going. And so, for example, with this one, there's scientific analysis that needs to be done. So who do I go to? The subject of another film that I'm doing that has to do with advanced propulsion systems. And he's a nanophysicist or a nanotechnician and, you know, has opened the doors to NASA Ames for me with an unrestricted, unescorted full film pass. I mean, incredible. So Nanoman, as I'm calling him now, although at some point we'll just, you know, he'll come on the show or give his real name, but I just, you know, need to put out the film pieces first, is a good friend, a trusted individual, and has the unique position of doing some of the coolest work on the planet scientifically, and in his own words, knows for a fact that the extraterrestrial presence is real, and that has informed and inspired his own work that was funded by the United States military. By the way,
you know this guy before you're going down this path?
No, I knew my military friends before going down this path, and they connected me to him, oddly enough. But look, again, all roads lead from Lear. Let's make it clear. There's two Lears we're talking about. One is John Lear, L-E-A-R, right? And the Godfather conspiracy. And then I'm making this other film, Patient 17, on Dr. Roger Lear, the implant removal surgeon, and you know, who has passed away. So those are the two Lears, and this path has led me now, as we're talking about, to Nanoman. And he's a guy that informs me about scientific stuff, and he's kind of part of the invisible college, you know. He's not out there in the public right now, although he will be at some point. He's a real strong individual. He's not afraid to give his opinion or tell the truth. Just right now, because I've been filming with him kind of in private and secret for like a few years, I'm just going to call him Nanoman.
You use the term invisible college. That's a term I know.
Yeah.
From Jacques Vallée. But what do you mean by it? Describe it.
Very specifically, what Jacques Vallée, you know, said is that there is a dedicated group of individuals who are willing to use their equipment and their finances and look at this, you know, soberly and scientifically. And, you know, I come in with a sample that is highly anomalous nanotechnology, and I'm like, will you take a look at it? And they don't scoff at it or just try to debunk it. They go with an open mind, look at it, and tell me what they see. And so what I mean by invisible college is, you know, they're not public people at this point. They're doing real scientific work, you know, funded by the United States military. But at the same time, they're willing to bring me, get me access into these labs, study these things, and look at them. But oftentimes, oddly enough, it's because they have had major breakthroughs in the realms of science because of what they've seen that they claim was not from here.
Meaning recovered technology, pieces of something?
Meaning technology that we could not and do not have the ability to fabricate at this time.
You have military people telling you this kind of stuff.
I do.
Can you describe, I mean, at what level? We're not talking about a sergeant or a captain here.
No. Look.
It's difficult. Yeah. You're having a difficult time with it.
I am, because, look, as you know, the point is people tell you things so that you know them, not so that you're going to repeat them. It's so that they guide you throughout your experiences so you know what a dead end is before you jump into it. So, yes, I have been able to get guidance from people within military, but also people within the scientific realms, the scientific fields. And they're all part of, I guess, look, some people want this information out, but I'm very confident to say that these technologies are real, that we're back engineering them. You take that with a pound of salt for all I care.
So there's a guy or a couple of guys in the military who sort of have told you this stuff, and at least one of them sends you in the direction of the guy you've come to know as Nanoman.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, there are a couple. Now one is a subcontractor that's been working in, you know, black projects, you know, for decades, and has told me very specifically certain things to help guide my path. And the other was active military, and helped guide what I'm looking into, and also take me away from the stuff that I was looking into that was just bogus. And
so did somebody know that Nanoman sort of had an interest in these kinds of subjects, or was working on the periphery?
Yeah. Actually, this is really simple. I just I had a book I couldn't read. It was all equations. It was about the gravitational, you know, field of the sun, and it was just way over my head. And I just wanted to know, was there anything to it? And a really good friend of mine, one of my best friends, was able to take that book and send it over to Nanoman. And he read through it, looked at all the equations, and kind of gave me a synopsis afterwards. That was the beginning of my education with Nanoman. I mean, he has taken me from I had no idea about, you know, four-dimensional reality and all this stuff. I mean, the guy just has schooled me. I had a new education with him over the last few years.
Okay, so his identity will be made public at some point.
You
said he got you into NASA Ames, got you a pass into NASA Ames.
Absolutely, and put me with a great technician for an entire day on the scanning electron microscope. And actually, I'm going to be premiering that short film called Utility Fog at the 2015 UFO Congress in February as well. So with my feature-length film, Patient 17, if you go to iamnanoman.com, you'll see there's a film I'm releasing that's a short called Utility Fog. And he got me into NASA for that film.
Oh, all right. We're going to talk more about Nanoman and some testing he did or opinions he gave you about Patient 17's mysterious object. The King of Rock and Roll takes us into the break. More with Jeremy Corbell right after this on Coast to Coast AM.